Thanks, Sam, for the introduction. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for the invitation. It really is an honor to be here. And great also to follow Jose. I guess I should just say I'm sorry I couldn't be here yesterday, so I hope I'm not too much covering territory that's already been covered. But great to follow Jose, who framed his talk by saying that he was going to focus on the we. And I'm actually going to focus on a couple of other terms in We Who Feel Differently. There's not that many left, so you can it's not who. It's feel indifferently. And I'm actually going to put some critical pressure on those terms, but the critical pressure is with the ultimate objective of getting to the we, so I think we share that goal. All right, so both feeling and difference are central to my work on the history of queer representation and experience. So I want to consider the significance of feeling and difference and of feeling different in the context of the contemporary moment of LGBT and queer life in the United States, and to suggest that both of these terms carry an extra burden of significance right now. So this moment, as I'll sketch it very briefly, is a complex one defined by remarkable new inclusions and by ongoing violence and stigma. This situation of new inclusions and continuing exclusions puts pressure on questions of feeling and difference. How different are we now? Where can difference or queer difference be found? What does it feel like to be on the inside of this new formation? And what does it feel like to be still outside? Queerness has long been associated with feeling different, and has been bound up with experiences of alienation and exclusion, as well as with willed departures from social norms. But the self-definition and the politics of non-normativity and marginality that has developed out of it are in a moment of crisis. Is queer, with its suggestion of a coalitional politics of marginal subjects, still a meaningful term to describe the politics and collectivity that we want to pursue now? I'm interested in considering the fate of queer feeling and the meaning of difference in queer communities in an era of widespread assimilation. In this context, I think it's important to address the official emotions, in Adorno's words, the prescribed happiness of mainstream LGBT politics and media, as well as the feelings of those excluded from this new consensus. So what is this moment? It's often named as the moment of neoliberalism, a moment marked by the triumph of market capitalism, increasing privatization, the dismantling of the state, corporatization, and the shrinking of the public sphere. The fit between neoliberalism, contemporary LGBT politics, and life has been described by many people in this room, but also Lisa Dugan, Jasbir Puar, Robert McCrewer, Lauren Berlant, Roderick Ferguson, Chandon Reddy, Miranda Joseph, Dean Spade, Tavin Yongo, and many others. Queer neoliberalism describes the commodification and privatization of queer life, the single issue identity politics, and the narrowing of the LGBT platform to focus on marriage and, well, basically marriage. Marriage is really at the center of mainstream LGBT politics in the present, and it's also an emblem of this moment of writing off the public good in the name of a privatized and normalizing politics of the couple and the family. Marriage, that peculiar institution, so long a focus of fantasy for queers excluded from dominant forms of kinship, has quickly proved to be a remarkably effective technology of inclusion. Political, economic, and affective resources are all being funneled into the couple and the reproductive family. There's no doubt that the forwarding of marriage and other civil rights has meant new life possibilities for some queers, for many queers, let's say. And the phrase homonormativity is meant to indicate not only assimilation as a historical process, but also the new resources that are bound up with normativity for gays and lesbians, and that come with a cost for those who are excluded by this new formation. The fact that inclusion is not a matter of progress for everyone is captured in the title of a special issue of the journal, the International Journal of Feminist Politics, that is now in progress. And that journal issue is called Murderous Inclusions, okay? Just to, I think, kind of identify this kind of contradictions of this moment. So in the call for papers, which I'm going to briefly cite, the editors, Jen Heredorn, Adi Kunzman, and Sylvia Pasoko write, quote, "Special issue seeks to critically examine parameters of sexual citizenship that accompany or work hand in hand with violent regimes of coloniality, wars on terror, development and structural adjustment, criminalization, pathologization, border enforcement, and neoliberalism. What new techniques of governance, they ask, can be mapped in a context of power which increasingly speaks the language of sexual and gender rights, protection, and diversity? What challenges arise from these complicities and convergences of queer inclusions, and how are they best addressed? What are the spaces of differences between situated and ever-shifting regimes of legal regulation and the ethical domain of queer politics and justice? And, you know, just to kind of give a shout out to some activism that's going on in Philadelphia right now, there is a kind of example of this sort of murderous inclusion happening there. That's where I live. The Equality Forum is celebrating its 20th anniversary as a national gay rights advocacy group by throwing its yearly conference with Israel as the featured nation. The celebration of Israel as a leader in civil rights is a really powerful example of the kinds of distortions produced by single issue politics. So in this context, in this moment, we who feel differently must be thoughtful about our complicity with new forms of violence and domination, pursued through the language of inclusion, rights, and diversity. At the same time, we continue to hold out the possibility of what those editors of the journal call an ethical domain of queer politics and justice. But how can we work toward expanding that ethical domain without perpetrating new forms of violence? And just where can difference be located these days? So my own work is situated in the field of affect studies, and it's my belief that the analysis of feelings can actually be a good way of getting at the contemporary paradoxes of queer inclusion and exclusion. For some, the decision to focus on feelings would itself be a symptom of neoliberalism because of the attention to the individual and the private sphere. But affect, as you know, many people who work in the field have argued, is not necessarily located in the person, nor is it private. Contemporary work on emotion has emphasized the intersubjective and relational qualities of affect, as well as the links between individual feelings and larger social structures. So the key text for this tradition is probably Raymond Williams' 1977 essay, Structures of Feeling, in which he argued for the importance of studying social experiences in solution. But this line has exploded as a field of inquiry and can be seen today, for one example, in the work of the Public Feelings Collective. Work on the politics of emotion today attempts to pry feeling out of the privatized sphere of the individual and the family, and to connect it back to the larger economic, political, and social structures that give it meaning. So work on feelings is especially important right now, certainly in the kind of part of queer academia that I know and in the queer art world. Affect studies is a broad interdisciplinary field and has been taken up by everyone from economists to cognitive scientists in the last decade or two. But it's had incredible purchase in the field of sexuality studies, to the point that sometimes these two fields, affect studies and queer studies, seem to converge. It's just like two names for the same thing, right? Why is this? It's not only that gays like to talk about their feelings, that's a big part of it, I think, but also that feeling is a particularly sensitive register of the conditions of the present. In the face, for instance, of mainstream LGBT platform based on inclusion that values pride above all else, the complexity of queer feelings is a testament to the unfinished work of justice. It's important to attend to the specificity of queer feeling and to continue to insist on all those feelings that do not fit with the present moment. So we might experience pride, but we also experience a far wider range of queer feelings: shame, anger, forced happiness, disappointment, militant melancholia, indignation, uncontrolled joy, resentment. I don't really have a problem with ressentiment, but that's we can take that up later maybe. Ambivalence, and wild, improbable hope. These complex and contradictory feelings can help us to map those new forms of inclusion and complicity, and to make visible ongoing as well as new forms of stigma, violence, and exclusion. So I just want to take one example, and I think it's one that's familiar to everybody, but I actually think it's a good sort of place to actually touch down and think about the sort of affective and political contradictions of the present. And that's it, the It Gets Better video archive online. And you know, I almost hesitate to talk about it because, you know, many other people have worked on it in my field, and it's almost like a sitting duck for people in queer studies, right? And I think the critiques are good, and they're out there. I'm gonna make some myself, but I think it's actually an interesting place to think about this kind of contradictory, ambivalent landscape that I want to sketch out today. So just briefly, this project was made by the journalist Dan Savage in response to a spate of gay suicides and phenomenon of bullying. He made this video with his boyfriend Terry Miller talking about their early struggles with homophobia and their later escape from those conditions. The video, and this is the format of the videos, is expressed addressed explicitly to queer youth, and the message is, no matter how bad things are now, don't kill yourself, hang in there, and make sure you're still around when things get better, which they will. It can get great, it can get awesome, Savage affirms. And watching the video, one has to admit that it has gotten really awesome for them, at least. The interview is interspersed with family photos, them with Savage's whole huge family, the two of them on vacation together, snowboarding in Switzerland with their son. That's what I'm saying. It's like, do I really need to even critique it? We can just, whatever. Okay. But given Savage's fame as an out gay columnist, professional gay, and his fabulous life with his like porn star boyfriend and their baby, or child, I guess he's it's an exaggeration, but one has to grant that in their case, at least, it has gotten a lot better. Toward the end of the video, Miller says, living well is the best revenge. He means that being happy is a form of revenge against the people who tormented you in high school. But if you're watching the video and you're not living as well as Savage and Miller, you may feel like a target rather than a co-conspirator in this revenge plot.
Wow.
Okay, so the Savage-Miller videos had like over a million views, and hundreds of other videos have been posted, most of which stick very closely to this formula, childhood torment, struggle, arrival at adult happiness. The campaign for It Gets Better has an extensive website featuring many of the videos, a way to upload your own, as well as opportunities to contribute to the campaign and to shop for merchandise. The narrative of overcoming and inevitable progress away from the hell of high school is scripted into the promotional materials on the website. Here's an excerpt from the About the Project page on the website. And this is really like the articulated core mission of the project. Growing up isn't easy. Many young people face daily tormenting and bullying, leading them to feel like they have nowhere to turn. This is especially true for LGBT kids and teens who often hide their sexuality for fear of bullying. Without other openly gay adults and mentors in their lives, they can't imagine what their future may hold. In many instances, gay and lesbian adolescents are taunted, even tortured, simply for being themselves. Justin Aubert, Billy Lucas, Cody Barker, Asher Brown, Seth Walsh, Raymond Chase, Tyler Clementi. They were tragic examples of youth who could not believe that it does actually get better. While many of these teens couldn't see a positive future for themselves, we can. The It Gets Better Project was created to show young LGBT people the levels of happiness, potential, and positivity their lives will reach if they can just get through their teen years. The It Gets Better Project wants to remind teenagers in the LGBT community that they are not alone and it will get better. And to me, the striking thing about this articulation of the project is the condescension. Teens can't see a positive future for themselves, we can. So there's a complete validation, as I see it, of the despair of these youth who, while they may not be able to see around the corner to the next phase of their life, have realized a truth about the social attitude toward queers. Also, the statement locates the problem that teens are facing not in social conditions, but in their attitude. Many young people face daily tormenting and bullying, leading them to feel like they have nowhere to turn. But the problem is that many of these young people don't, in fact, have anywhere to turn, not that they feel that way. Finally, as in any campaign that tries to turn the losses of the past into political gains for the future, there's the danger of instrumentalizing the dead. From singular individuals, they are transformed into tragic examples. Their tragedy is not that they were sacrificed to a crushing social order, but that they could not believe that it actually gets better, i.e. they hadn't been exposed to the It Gets Better campaign. Okay, so as I said, for somebody kind of coming out of my area of queer studies, critical of normativity, arguing against a teleological progressive view of queer history, It Gets Better is sort of like a city duck. It's an easy target. Apart from refusing to take seriously the live difficulties of queer and transgender youth, the project represents a vision of achieved gay life that is elitist, white, nationalist, metropolitan, and gender normative. For me, this vision of gay life drains away all of the interest that being queer might once have had. The project, rather than seeing over the rainbow as an image of fantasy and longing, suggests that Oz is a real place that you can move to. In this new context, self-invention, wistfulness, regret, desire, irony, and overinvestment will be way less useful to you than a good real estate agent. For many, Savage and Miller represent important positive role models for those who are struggling with shame and isolation, but I think they make it clear how much we need negative role models, which is to say people who are actively struggling and who are more available for identification by mere mortals. For many people watching that video, I think the perfection of their life can have damaging consequences. It seems to me that one's primary response to this video might well be, there's no way to get there from here. So the campaign's been heavily criticized by queer academics, and in her piece in The Guardian, Jasbir Puar quoted this blogger, Quiet Riot Girl, and I think this just gives you a good sense of the critique. Quote, basically the YouTube project suggests support for queer youth has to stay on message and upbeat. Dissent and diversity does not seem to be encouraged. This is borne out by the vast number of videos being uploaded by white university-educated gay men in comparison to those from women, transgender people, and working class people, and people from diverse ethnic backgrounds. Okay. So, nonetheless, despite my own adverse reaction to the project and I think these spot-on critiques, I'm not sure that an utter condemnation if it gets better is in order. For one thing, many people clearly have found the project to be sustaining, and since it's in the service of trying to work against suicide of queer youth and transgender youth, I don't really see trashing it as a kind of appropriate response. Also, I think the sheer number of videos that have been posted online means that there really isn't one single narrative about it gets better, although when there is a single narrative, as in the about section, I think it's really messed up. And it's true that I would say probably that the vast majority of these videos are almost scarily on message, but the project is more complex. And I think it, in fact, might be understood as a kind of archive of feelings in Anne Svekovich's sense. That's to say, we have many people attesting to the bullying they experienced in high school, describing their depression, their despair, and their suicide attempts. And so it's not clear to me if the message of affirmation is really what's helping people or actually the sort of potential identifications that are opened up by people talking honestly about their experiences of suffering. So rather than say, okay, it gets better, it's all evil, I think we have to see that it's a kind of complex instance that might help us to think about key issues in the present about the politics of emotion. This project holds the potential to initiate a dialogue about the long-term effects of violence and trauma and the complexities of gay, lesbian life across generations, about intersections of class, race, gender, and sexuality, about the significance and relevance of progress narratives, both for individuals and historically, and about what we think constitutes better today. What makes for a good life? What does a good gay life look like today? We need to have these discussions now because in the increasingly polarized present, it can seem like only two positions are available. In the context of it gets better, either suicide or a fulfilled happy adulthood. In the context of just sort of general politics now, homonormativity, gay marriage and assimilation, or radical queerness and the total refusal of the existing social order. What is left out mostly, I think, is that rich and uneven territory of mixed feelings and mixed realities, inclusion and exclusion, which is where we actually live. Feeling indifference and feeling different are then, I want to argue, as important as they've ever been in queer culture, but I think we need to fine-tune our account of both as we attempt to account for new inclusions, new exclusions, and the feelings they produce. And we need to remember that difference is, to invoke Judith Butler's words about gender, not a noun, but a verb. Audre Lorde suggests the importance of understanding difference as a dynamic principle rather than a fixed quantity in Zami when she comes to the realization that her place, quote, was the very place of difference rather than the security of any one particular difference. Difference is a moving target. If we were able to identify, name, and solidify the qualities of difference, it wouldn't be difference anymore. What once counted as queer difference now might be seen as a technology of murderous inclusion. and our fights for civil rights are producing new forms of violence and stigmatization. And yet difference remains as crucial a resource of critique and collectivity as ever. My suggestion is that attention to the specificity of difference and the shifting grounds of inclusion and exclusion, new and old forms of stigma, as well as the feelings they produce, will help us to gain critical purchase on the present and to imagine alternatives to what seems to be a foreclosed future. Thanks.